these are the ones that play an important role in what we want to, how we want to address this question.
Yeah, thank you so much. Brother Mudal, let's take a short break over here, and your audience, do not go anywhere. We'll be right back after the break.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience. And before the break, we were talking about different cultures, Islamic culture and Western culture. And we were talking about their aspects of the different cultures. So, Brother Mudal, please continue.
The first point I'd like to mention regarding this interlap and this relationship between Islamic culture and other cultures is that Islam as such doesn't have a culture that would be complete as such. Like, mm-hmm. I won't say that Islam has very specific things that you have to eat, very specific clothes that you have to wear, very specific language that you have to talk. Mm-hmm. None of these are part of an Islamic culture, right? In that sense, Islam is very, the religion comes rather to help the cultures to achieve their potential.
So Islam has given us the standards.
Islam gives us principles, right?
Yeah.
So for example, Islam, just like a culture will say, for example, I don't know, the Italian culture, for example, based on a typical type of food, a typical type of way of speaking, a language, a dress code, etc. Islam will come and adapt these to fit a general principle that goes back to the goal of the human being and the fitra of the human being, and to make this human being reach its perfection, which is the servitude of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So for example, Islam won't come and say that you have to eat, I don't know, this particular type of food. But it will come and say that your food has to be halal.
Yeah, that's right.
It will come and say, for example, that your food has to be slaughtered, your meat has to be slaughtered in a particular way. It will come and tell you, for example, don't eat too much, just as you don't want to eat too less. It will come and say, for example, before you start eating, say Bismillah. So the etiquettes of eating, the what to eat, how to eat, when to eat, it will give you guidelines, basically.
But this like in every aspect of life.
Exactly. Every aspect of life. And these guidelines can be adopted in any culture, whether you can be Iranian, whether you can be Iraqi, whether you can be British, whether you can be Italian or Brazilian. It doesn't make a difference. As long as you adapt these principles and these guidelines in your culture, your culture can be directed towards what you want to achieve as a human being, which is your path and your goal and your journey towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So in the example, coming back to the question example that you mentioned, for example, the dishtasha, right? The dishtasha, for those who don't know, is the long piece of cloth that Arabs wear, usually. Usually white. You see Saudi Arabians and Iraqis, they wear these big long piece of cloth, quite elegant usually. It looks quite nice. Now you can say from one aspect is it's part of a Middle East culture, right? I wouldn't say it's an Islamic culture, right? In the sense that you wouldn't say that if somebody who doesn't wear dishtasha is not a Muslim or is far from achieving his potential and won't achieve the goal of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala if they don't wear dishtasha.
That's
not the case. We don't have anywhere in Islam that you have to wear dishtasha.
So is there any dress that we can call it as Islamic dress?
So the Islamic dress will be a dress that covers your body in a way that brings about modesty. That brings about an appearance that is a good presentable appearance. So any cloth. So you take a trousers and a shirt, for example. You take a suit. You take a Punjabi dress, for example, right? You take a Brazilian hat, for example. I don't know. You take all these different types of clothing. As long as they fit in the set, they're presentable. Mm-hmm. They look nice, decent. They present the human value and dignity of the human being. Mm-hmm. They cover your body in a humble way. Mm-hmm. Okay, these are guidelines. Mm-hmm. So if you come out, for example, wearing feminine, a man comes out and wears women clothes, for example, or wear clothes that are so dirty that it actually doesn't, you don't feel like talking to this person. Mm-hmm. These are against Islamic, you would say, guidelines, basically that. But no, they're clothes from different types of culture, but they fit in the principle of the Islamic guidelines, then it's fine. They don't have to be at this dasha as such.
Thank you so much, brother, from that. Let's take a short break over here. Ya muqiya al-khayrat, ya
muqiya al-khayrat. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back to your audience, and before the break we were discussing about the different dressing forms and how we can have different dressing forms with respect to the Islamic principles.
The other example that we used in the example in the question, sorry, is rings, right? So again, for those who are not aware, we have in Islamic culture or in Islamic guidelines, we have these special rings that are recommended for men and also women to wear as well, which is, for example, the Aqiq stone or the Firoda stone. Mm-hmm. There are different types of stones that we have in our traditions, and now the Ahlul Bayt have taught us that these are good things to wear. Now, this is where you have, this particular example comes more in the aspect of guidelines, basically, where this is not related to any culture, okay? But rather, Islam says that whatever culture you are, whether you can be a British culture, American culture, South African culture, a Chinese or Indonesian culture, this goes back to a guideline that's applicable to any culture, that in every culture that you are, this kind of, you would call it jewelry for men, or these kind of rings, basically, and these kind of stones, they're recommended for every, because they go back to helping you on your journey. Obviously, it's not obligatory, but they go and help you in your journey towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is not related to any culture. This is not something to do specifically with Arabs, for example, or specifically to do with Persian. This is something to do with, goes back to what Islam teaches us. So this is something definitely that we would try and encourage our children, try and incorporate in our lives as well. If we are able to, then definitely wear the ring. It doesn't go back to being from the Middle East. It goes back to being part of an Islamic culture, basically. So wherever you live, I would definitely recommend that this is worth thinking. And it doesn't go against any other culture as well. It's not something that if you wear, for example, in the West, it'll be seen as bad. No, on the contrary, it's seen as, I mean, in the West, we have different types of rings, different types of rings that are in fashion. Muslims can wear the blue ring, for example, which is the Firoda, or the red ring, for example, the yellow one, whichever stone you like that are recommended in our tradition. So to conclude, I know we're coming to the end of the show. I wanted to put across this point that we have to be able to analyze, which is the culture part and how Islam plays a role in bringing these principles to different types of cultures, and those things that are part of those principles. That's one of them was the ring, for example.
So thank you so much, Brother Madad, and thanks so much to your audience for staying with us. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. Fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life. A complete way, it's a complete way.
E
in the limelight. The Srebrenica massacre remains the single worst atrocity conducted on European soil since the end of the Second World War, more than a quarter of a century later, as new details emerge in a recent report about how Western powers and the United Nations contributed to other atrocities committed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We now present you an article written by staff writers of the Middle East Eye. The piece is titled, Released Documents Reveal UK Planned Srebrenica Pullout Despite Being Aware of Imminent Carnage. Classified documents show the British government devised plans to withdraw troops from a besieged Muslim enclave at the height of the Serbian onslaught in Bosnia-Herzegovina in July of 1995. Despite being aware of mass killing of thousands by local Serb forces in nearby Srebrenica, nearly 8,300 Muslim men and boys were later found to have been murdered at Srebrenica after a Dutch contingent of the United Nations so-called peacekeeping force deployed in Bosnia withdrew from the town. The Srebrenica massacre, for which Bosnia Serb leaders were later convicted of genocide, remains the single worst atrocity conducted on European soil since the end of the Second World War, more than a quarter of a century later, as the UK-based Middle East Eye News outlet reveals new details in a recent report about how Western powers and the United Nations contributed to other atrocities committed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The report, which used declassified British government documents about Bosnian crisis, also points to a new widely acclaimed Bosnian movie, Quo Vadis, Aida, that sheds new light on the tragic carnage in Srebrenica and what it described as the catastrophic failure of the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the region as Yugoslavia collapsed into war and violence. Quo Vadis, Aida, directed by Jasmila Zabanić, a survivor of the near four-year siege of the major Bosnian city of Sarajevo by local Serb forces, the movie has been nominated as the best international feature film at the 2021 Oscars and as the best foreign language film at the British BAFTA Awards. According to the released documents, another Bosnian Muslim enclave of Gorazde, where British soldiers made up the main contingent of United Nations peacekeepers, came very close to facing the same fate as Srebrenica. The documents paint a vivid behind-the-scenes picture of Western leaders striving to choose the least worst option presented to them by their advisors, without much regard for the fate of Bosnia's Muslim population facing massacres and other atrocities that were overtly being carried out by Serbian forces. They further revealed that the then British Prime Minister John Major was reluctant to reinforce Gorazde in order to protect its population of more than 30,000, despite, as his private secretary put it, the distressing scenes now daily on our television screens. The documents further show that the British Defence Ministry drafted emergency plans for the evacuation of British troops from the area around Gorazde in July of 1995, at the exact moment that genocidal slaughter was underway at Srebrenica and a third enclave in Zepa had come under attack. Gorazde had come under Bosnian Serb attack in 1994 and again in May of 1995. Gorazde, located on a strategically vital crossroads and surrounded by towering cliffs, was highly vulnerable to another Serbian attack and potential carnage following the fall of Srebrenica and Zepa. The report noted that three eastern towns had been declared safe havens for Muslim Bosniaks by the United Nations Security Council in 1993, after the surrounding territory had been captured by Belgrade-backed Bosnian Serb forces opposed to Bosnia and Herzegovina's declaration of independence in 1992. The report also pointed out that the UN Security Council resolutions had also established that United Nations peacekeepers were only authorized to deter attacks on the three enclaves, but not to protect or defend them. Force could be used only in self-defense. On 16th of July 1995, with a final onslaught against Gorazde, thought to be imminent, British plans, codenamed Operation Screwdriver, to evacuate 350 British soldiers from the town of Gorazde was finalised at the Ministry of Defence in London. According to the report, the disclosure of the British evacuation plans came as little surprise to men who served in the Army of Bosnia-Herzegovina during the war. It then cited Farid Buljubasic, who had served as a lieutenant colonel in the Yugoslav National Army before commanding Bosnian forces in Gorazde from mid-1992 to the end of 1994, as recalling that the so-called United Nations Protection Force, or UNPROFOR, were being led largely by officers who did not understand the nature of the war. Farid Buljubasic recounted that NATO aircraft in 1994 bombed Serb tanks that had already been destroyed. He said, "I would say that the role of the international community in general in Bosnia and Herzegovina was very dishonorable." He further emphasized, "My general impression is that they never understood the character of war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, that they were never neutral, that they faked execution of their tasks, and there is so much evidence that they were extremely inclined towards the Serbs." He added, "They ignored and disregarded the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina, as well as the army of Bosnia and Herzegovina. There was politics in all of that." The released documents also make clear that the British Prime Minister at the time, John Major, was determined that the United Kingdom should not be sucked into war with Bosnian Serb forces, and that his senior military commander, Field Marshal Peter Inge, fully supported that decision. Farid Buljubasic further pointed out that a group of 20 British Special Air Service or SAS soldiers had been hurriedly evacuated from Gorazde whilst the enclave came under attack in April of 1994. He noted they had been posted to the town as the eyes and ears of UNPROFOR commander Michael Rose, who was himself a British general. Buljubasic added, "When they came, they were pumped up, dressed, they had vests, all sorts of things, camouflage paint. The very moment it got troubling, they vanished." He said, "As the attacks went on, and as the Chetniks or Bosnian Serb forces were getting close to Gorazde, one night those SAS, a helicopter came to pick them up. They took their stuff and ran away without letting anyone know, without anything. They just disappeared. They just disappeared and vanished in one night." The former Bosnian commander observed that the behavior of the forces of UNPROFOR, the United Nations peacekeeping forces, would have been identical to the Dutch at Srebrenica, if not even more shameful. Meanwhile, US President at the time, Bill Clinton, was expressing his frustration at the Bosnian government whilst they were struggling to defend themselves amid the United Nations imposed arms embargo, whereas the Bosnian Serb forces had inherited large amounts of weaponry from the army of the former Yugoslavia. During a telephone conversation with John Major, Bill Clinton was recorded to have said, "We could hardly blame the Dutch for leaving Srebrenica when the Bosnians themselves had already given up the fight." He further claimed, "The Bosnians made a habit of trying to make other people look bad in the press." The report points out that some sections of the British record of these Clinton major telephone conversations remained redacted more than a quarter century later on national security grounds, following the 2019 declassification of the bulk of the UK government papers on the period. Following the fall of Srebrenica and the attack on Zepa underway, British Prime Minister at the time John Major concluded that Bosnian Serbs would next turn to Goražde, as the British ambassador in Belgrade reported that the Bosnian Serb army was under high after capturing Srebrenica with so little United Nations opposition and was dangerously unpredictable. However, John Major told both French President Jacques Chirac and US President Bill Clinton that he believed only diplomatic pressure should be applied in an attempt to save Goražde. According to the report, the Americans regarded Goražde as a problem for the British and French to deal with and regarded the defense of Sarajevo as a more serious strategic objective. The top British commander in Bosnia, Field Marshal Peter Inge, recommended that if the UK government decided its troops should remain in Goražde, we should do so as robustly as possible under a pure peacekeeping and humanitarian mandate option and then seek a negotiated withdrawal with dignity, as the Dutch have done, but being prepared to use air power.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ما Mali has been plagued by instability and conflict. It was in 2012 when Tuareg separatists, allied with Al-Qaeda and Daesh-linked groups, launched a rebellion and took control of the north. But soon after, the terrorist groups pushed over the Tuareg rebels and seized key northern cities. However, in the early 2013, Malian forces, together with French troops and soldiers from other African countries, drove them out and gained back control. Since then, Daesh terrorist groups regularly carry out raids against the army and civilians in Mali's central and northern regions. In recent years, fighting has spread across the arid Sahel region into Burkina Faso and Niger, with a deteriorating security situation in the region unleashing a major humanitarian crisis. Violence and insecurity have already pushed some 7.4 million people across three countries into acute hunger. Meanwhile, the number of internally displaced people has reached 1.6 million in 2020. That figure included more than 288,000 people in Mali, some 265,000 in Niger, and 1 million in Burkina Faso, which is now home to the world's fastest-growing displacement crisis. At least 1,000 people overall have died in attacks this year, including soldiers and terrorists. The first 3 months of 2021 have seen more non-combatant deaths blamed on terrorist groups than the same period last year. The UN peacekeeping force, also known as MINUSMA, was established in Mali in 2013 and has over 13,000 peacekeepers from several countries. Over 230 peacekeepers have died in the country, and that has made Mali the UN's most dangerous peacekeeping operation.
Well, Mali is one of the key hubs for the jihadi African Muslim movement. It's all of North Africa right now. You've got Chad, Libya, Sudan, they're, you know, Central African Republic, even obviously North Nigeria, and then even Northern Cameroon.
France, a former colonizer of Africa, intervened in Mali in 2013 to fight back increasing militant activity. Mali has received support in its fight against the armed groups from France's Barkhane Force, which numbers 5,100 troops spread across the arid Sahel region. In addition to Mali, French force has been fighting armed groups alongside soldiers from the G5 Sahel countries, namely Mauritania, Chad, Burkina Faso, and Niger. However, the French anti-terror mission Barkhane is losing support in Mali. Hundreds of people took to the streets in the capital Bamako to protest against the presence of French troops in the Sahel region. They burned the French flag and carried banners, reading slogans such as "Down with France." A recent UN probe found France guilty of killing civilians in central Mali. On January 3, French fighter jets targeted a wedding with nearly 100 guests near Bounty Village in central Mali. A UN report said that 19 civilians, as well as 4 militants, were killed. The French Defense Ministry, however, disputed the finding, saying the strike targeted an armed terrorist group. However, the UN rejected Paris's claims.
The French are heavily involved, trying to control their resources. Mali's a very rich country in gold, and it's a very valuable asset. Other than that, surprisingly, it's not that rich, but it has a significant amount of gold reserves. It's considered probably one of the richest reserves in the world.
Paris has intervened in Mali in an effort to stop terrorists advancing in the region. However, there are more important things than the lives of over 5,100 French troops. The African country's gold and uranium mines are an incentive for France's current military intervention in that region.
Shortly after taking office as South Vietnam's president in 1955, pro-American Ngo Dinh Diem began a crackdown on suspected members of the Viet Minh Communist Coalition of the North. The Cold War was in full swing, and the United States, which was concerned about a rise in communism, gradually ramped up its military presence in Vietnam. Washington finally found the excuse to justify a war in the region following an incident in the Gulf of Tonkin in 1963 when two U.S. destroyers were targeted by a torpedo attack by the North Vietnamese forces. The U.S. Congress then approved the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which authorized U.S. military action in the region. The conflict that ensued has been regarded as one of the bloodiest wars the US has ever been involved in. American troops resorted to using warfares, including napalm and chemical toxins, to confront their enemy. Perhaps the most notorious was a chemical substance called Agent Orange that was used during Operation Ranch Hand to defoliate jungles to uncover Vietnamese troops and destroy crops between 1961 and 1971. The substance contained dioxin, which is one of the most toxic chemicals known to man and has been linked to severe birth defects, cancers, and mental and physical disabilities.
I mean, this is, you have to understand that America has a different standard for the rest of the world than it does at home. At home, America adheres to fairly high level standards when it comes to herbicides, for example, of which Agent Orange is one. But when it comes to the poor nations of the world, such as Laos or Cambodia, a completely different standard applies.
The U.S. failure in the war and its atrocities in terms of the number of civilian deaths and the use of chemical weapons has tarnished America's image at home and abroad to date. The U.S. rained down some 600,000 gallons of herbicides on the neutral nation of Laos and roughly 19 million gallons of such chemicals in Vietnam. The chemicals were so potent that even American troops got a taste of their detrimental effects. After 14 years of legal dispute, the U.S. Congress passed the Orange Agent Act in 1991 to compensate American veterans of the Vietnam War who were exposed to the toxin. But it wasn't until the year 2000 that Washington started to admit responsibility for what the people of Vietnam and Laos have been going through. Washington kicked off a 10-year project to decontaminate swathes of Vietnamese land from the herbicide in 2019, but stopped short of awarding compensation to the families of the victims. There's also no mention of U.S. chemical attacks on neutral Laos during the war. Even after the American military acknowledged the attacks, a former American commander denied all knowledge about the use of dioxin there.
Laos was a country that was caught in the middle of the Indo-Chinese War. The U.S. Was absolutely indiscriminate in its use of Agent Orange and other weapons of war against the population. It never apologized. It never had any second thoughts. As far as the U.S. was concerned, it was just a collateral damage. So the U.S. has never made good on that. It's never made good on the enormous damage that was done to Cambodia, or certainly the incredible bloodshed that was imposed on Vietnam.
The Vietnam War ended long ago, but not for thousands of people living in Vietnam and Laos who are still being haunted by its effects.
The annual United States Report on Global Human Rights Practices looked at human rights issues in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza as part of its global analysis on almost 200 nations. In the first such report of the Biden administration, the U.S. reaffirmed the recognition of Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights and the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That is while Washington has refused to slam the Israeli regime for its illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories as well as other crimes. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem outlets. That is while the UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Also, according to human rights groups, acts of violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and their property are a daily occurrence throughout the occupied West Bank. Additionally, Israel holds more than 7,000 Palestinians in its jails. Most of the prisoners are being held with no indictments or trial under a controversial policy known as administrative detention.
Well, in the first place, the U.S. lacks the moral authority to talk about human rights in any country outside of its own boundaries. Inside the U.S., there is systemic racism against people of color, and against people of indigenous origin. And this has been going on for 400 years inside the what is now the United States. Their record has been terrible. And to just a couple of days ago, the trial of the police man who killed George Floyd is taking place. So the U.S. has no moral authority whatsoever.
The Israeli regime's crimes seem to have no end, and the international community only condemns the regime's atrocities in words. This is while Israel is violating international law. The Golan Heights were part of Syria until 1967, when the Israeli regime captured most of the area during the Six-Day War. In 1973, Egypt and Syria launched a war against the Israeli regime in an effort to recapture the occupied territories. However, with Washington's help, Israel managed to retain control over the territory it occupied before. Then in 1981, Israel declared its unilaterally annexing East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights in order to extend its own boundaries to cover the captured territories. In response, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 497 and condemned the annexation of Syrian territory. The Council declared the annexation a violation of international law. Meanwhile, Syria has repeatedly reaffirmed its sovereignty over the Golan Heights, saying the territory must be completely restored to its control. The Golan Heights territory is strategically important due to its military value. It is also a strategic asset due to its water resources and fertile land. In a relatively parched region of the world, control over the Golan's water supplies is invaluable. The Golan Heights may also have oil. Exploratory drilling suggests that the territory's reservoirs could potentially yield billions of barrels of oil. The annual United States report on global human rights practices also reaffirmed Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which the U.S. recognized in 2019. In March 2019, the former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a decree recognizing Israeli sovereignty over Golan during a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington. The Syrian government denounced Washington's recognition of Israeli claims over the Golan Heights as a blatant attack on the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Over the past decades, Israel has built dozens of settlements in the Golan Heights in defiance of international calls for the regime to stop its illegal construction activities.
Indeed, they are illegal, and nothing that the U.S. says or does can turn a crime into a legal act. Except for the USA, the entire world recognizes that the Golan Heights are part of the sovereign territory of Syria, and someday Syria will regain control of the Golan Heights.
The trial of former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin began earlier this week. Chauvin is accused of killing 46-year-old African-American George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest last May. Floyd's death triggered worldwide protests over brutal policing tactics and racial injustice. Prosecutors have said the former Minneapolis officer killed Floyd without regard for his life. They insist Chauvin betrayed his badge by kneeling on Floyd's neck and using excessive and unreasonable force as the black man kept begging for his life.
So you'd want to get him off out of
the high-profile trial is expected to take 1 month. During the next few weeks, prosecutors will ask medical and use of force experts, among others, to testify. If convicted of murder and manslaughter charges, the former police officer could be jailed for decades. Chauvin has denied the charges. His defense lawyers argue that the force used during the arrest was reasonable and that Floyd died of an overdose and poor health. U.S. police officers who cause a death while they're on duty are rarely charged, and only about a third of those charged are convicted. This ongoing trial is followed across the U.S. and around the world as a strong indication of how the American legal system treats deaths in police custody.
About
The ongoing trial has captured media attention in the U.S. and around the world. Everyone wants to know how the proceedings will end. But there is still a strong possibility that justice will not be served in Floyd's case, just as it wasn't served in many other high-profile police killings of unarmed African Americans over the past years. The 2014 police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson was another example in which the white officer who shot the black man was not indicted. Black Americans are disproportionately more likely to be fatally shot by police and arrested for drug abuse, and five times more likely than white Americans to be imprisoned. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon.
Black people in the United States are incarcerated, jailed, locked up, arrested more than any other race at more than any other rate in this country, disproportionate to their percentage of the population. Even though black people in the United States represent just over 13% of the population, they're targeted and they're victimized more to the prison industrial complex more than any other group in the United States. And that's something that we really have to begin to tackle in the United States to understand the roots of the prison industrial complex, of the police as catchers of enslaved people.
Observers largely attribute this trend to the racist roots of American policing and social structures. Law enforcement in many U.S. states, especially those in the south of the United States, have their roots in slave patrols that were formed centuries ago. Such patrols located and forcefully returned enslaved people who had escaped.
The first reason for police to begin with to exist in the United States were to catch enslaved people who liberated themselves from their owners, who fled to the north. And that's why you'll see the first badges of the police from the 1800s said the words slave patrol, because that was one of their first jobs, to catch liberated enslaved peoples who were running to the north for freedom, for economic opportunity. That's the roots of policing in the United States, and we have to contend with that in order to deal with this.
The federal government banned the use of racist regulations at the state and local level many decades ago. Yet, ethnic minorities are subject to discrimination and profiling. Former U.S. President Donald Trump gained notoriety for fueling racial tensions and discrimination through provocative comments and stances. His successor, Joe Biden, has been an outspoken critic of racial injustice. But it remains to be seen whether he can truly lead the U.S. towards a less racially discriminative future.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Allah, 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 All
talk about some of the laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
You know, we are talking about Islamic laws according to Ayatollah Sistani's viewpoints and about, you know, sorted things of miscellaneous nature.
Yeah.
This is a very important question because it's pretty common in many countries, including Islamic countries, where
yes.
We have wedding ceremonies, and normally, even if the males and females are separated in those Muslim countries, they need to hire a camera person.
Yeah.
And this camera person, in fact, films the whole wedding,
mm-hmm.
both in fact, in the female gatherings and the male gatherings,
yeah.
right? So is it permissible for the person involved,
yeah.
You know, or for the person who hires such people as
yeah.
camera people to shoot the ceremony, all right? Is it permissible, to have this kind of, let's say, gathering, attend these gatherings, and is it permissible for the camera person, in fact, to be engaged in filming such gatherings?
Yes. Obviously, the camera person, you just said the camera person, but that camera person could be a man
yes.
or a woman
right.
entering a gathering of the opposite gender or sex.
Mm-hmm.
Ayatollah Sistani is of the view that it's not permissible for a person, for a cameraman to enter a woman's gathering, filming them,
right,
taking their photos. It's not permissible, and the reason is clear, because women in a wedding ceremony are wearing their ornaments.
Yes.
They're wearing their makeup.
They are not in full hijab, you mean?
Yeah, they are not. Some of them, and maybe most of them, do not wear hijab, and they do not. Some of them do not care about hijabs in such places, because they think there's no man seeing them.
Yes.
And so they take off their scarves and they do not wear the normal. They do not observe the dress code in such gatherings.
Right.
And so it's not permissible for a cameraman to enter such gatherings and to videotape them, to film them, and then take the video to the studio,
right,
and edit this, such films. It's absolutely forbidden, because as I said, the reason is clear. The same, the position is the same with a woman entering a man gathering. A woman should not a woman should not enter a man gathering where men are actually might be looking at her, or she might be looking at boys and men, and therefore. Even if you just say that, okay, the video, there is a lady filming the video, the woman, mm-hmm. and then a man, there's a man
filming the man.
Yeah, filming the man. But then, are they going to give the video to the bride and the groom to see and to keep in their houses, or they're going to edit?
Yes.
If they are going to,
that's my next question. Yeah. I was just going to ask you, yes, about, in fact, the person who's engaged in the editing or addition of such video footages.
Yes.
And we all know that it must be given to somebody with enough expertise, in fact, sure, to edit the footages, you know. Mm. So is it still permissible to give such videos of the wedding ceremonies to such, in fact, experts?
There's no doubt that it's not permissible to give such videos to such people to, mm-hmm, edit them.
Yes.
Because not only it's not permissible, but it's very much likely that the video might be released and may and might start circulating,
mm-hmm,
on the internet, or maybe posted somewhere. Okay, the images or, and maybe those images or videos might be misused by someone intentionally or unintentionally. Okay, such incidents have occurred many a time. Okay, and therefore it's not permissible,
mm-hmm,
regardless of whether, irrespective of whether the video is given to a third party or not. But since it's very much likely that the video might be misused, and then there is a man editing, mm-hmm, there are men could be editing the video,
yes,
and looking at those pictures, and looking at those women who might be known, okay? Because if for example, I know,
yes,
those women in the pictures, the sin of watching and looking at them is greater than when I do not know them, okay?
Right.
So it's not permissible.
I see.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Sheikh Javid, let me change the scenario.
Yeah.
Because we've been talking about Islamic countries so far.
Yes.
But what about the Western countries? Is it permissible, according to Ayatollah Sistani?
Yes.
What's the Islamic law? What's his ruling about a Muslim cameraman filming ceremonies in Western gatherings? We all know that in the West, they don't care about, in fact, males and females when they are mixed, mm-hmm, right? So in such gatherings, they actually socialize together, both males and females, mm-hmm, right? So is it permissible for a Muslim cameraman, all right,
yes,
to shoot such ceremonies? We know how it's cursed, the job or the jobs are in the West, all right?
Yes.
It's pretty hard actually to find a job there. Mm-hmm. So if you're working for a company there,
yes,
all right, so
sure,
you're going to lose your job, you're going to be fired. if you don't follow the rules. So the company asks you, in fact, to go to such ceremonies and shoot the ceremony. All right?
Yeah.
So what is it?
Well, it depends on the on the gathering. The cameraman is a Muslim, as you mentioned, but
yes.
The gathering is also a Muslim gathering, okay?
Yes.
The position is the same when it comes to filming and shooting the gathering.
Yes.
But as far as a non-Muslim gathering is concerned, of course, they always have a mixed gathering, okay, of men and women sitting together in the same hall. It is not permissible to shoot such gatherings as long as the intention is to, let's say, if the intention is to drive pleasure, you see, because it may happen that the cameraman might fall into a sin looking at girls, and normally in such places women do not wear hijab. If women proper clothes, let alone hijab, proper hijab, okay, because they are partially naked in such a place, of course a Muslim cannot enter, cannot go, no matter what the consequence, you see. There are some haram things you cannot do, even if there is a risk of doing or losing your job, you see. For example, you cannot sell alcohol, wine, pork, no matter what the excuse, okay?
Yes. But if you walk in the streets, all right, even the streets are full of such partially naked women.
Okay, but then you have to lower your gaze, you see?
Right.
That's what the Quran says. You should lower your gaze and should not look at girls and women with lustful intention.
Yes, but if you don't have the lustful intentions and you're still a camera person and a Muslim.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
So this
why do you have to? Why do you have to, for example, shoot passers-by?
No. I'm not talking about the passers-by. No, in the weddings. All right.
Yes.
So if you are given this job as a camera person and you are a Muslim camera person, and you are asked to shoot such ceremonies,
but because they are girls partially naked and they are not properly dressed, it's not permissible. Okay, if they were just women without scarves, you could film them as long as you do not have the intention to seek sexual pleasure. Okay, but you see, women they do not wear proper clothes on the wedding day, and seeing such women, even if the intention is not to drive pleasure, because you are very much likely to fall into a sin. It's not permissible, yes, to video tape such gatherings.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio.